This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. It is the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. As in the Sky Bet Championship, the top two both have a wobbly week. In Sky Bet League One, Hull City and Ipswich Town continue to go in opposite directions. And in Sky Bet League Two, Leighton Orient and Scunthorpe United are both on the up. Big name interviews, topical reflection and top punditry from those within the game or who follow it closely. It's the official EFL podcast. So the Carlisle United Chief Executive Nigel Clibbins and Lee Johnson's thoughts on the return of supporters to EFL grounds to come. But first, can there be any greater sight in football than a number nine reeling away in celebration after hitting the back of the net? Well, of course not if it's your club on the receiving end, but most certainly if it's for your team, as it has been 11 times, nine in the league so far this season for Sky Bet League One's current top scorer, Portsmouth's John Marquis. Am I making too much of a fuss about the number nine on a striker's back? Do you care what number you wear, John?
I suppose a little bit. Sometimes it's got a bit of sentimental value, but I've always, when possible, wore the number nine. It is my sort of favourite number to wear, and I think it's a nice feeling knowing you're the number nine of his team, and you're sort of wanting to be the main man to lead the line for the boys, and when the goals are going in as well, it's very nice.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I suppose conversely, if it's a really legendary shirt, I obviously think of number nines of somebody like Newcastle with that great line of Shearers and before Andy Coles and before Wyn Davies going way, way back. So I suppose the history could wear you down as well if you're not in a great scoring spell.
Yeah, I suppose, as you say, I think sort of you look at Newcastle, that's a big one there, and Alan Shearer was my sort of idol when I was growing up, and the famous number nine at Newcastle was obviously one that people spoke about a lot, and they've had some players that have wore it since that have done well and some that haven't done so well. So at some clubs there's obviously a bit of an extra burden, I suppose, as you say, when there's sentimental value to it for the club itself. But I think as players, you need to just, you need to worry about the badge on the front and not the number on the back. And but if you're there and you're happy, and sometimes it's just subconsciously, it gives you a better feeling if you know that you're excited to be wearing a number that means so much to the club.
And playing in the role of traditional centre forward, because I was a little bit worried about you, because I saw you back in March and I think you were being played slightly out of your favoured position. Obviously quite happy to do it for the team. Have you had a little tweak back to central? Is that why you're really hitting the goals haul substantially early doors?
Yeah, obviously, last season it was my first year at Portsmouth, and we started the season slowly, and it cost us in the end, and having to try and go up through the playoffs, which we couldn't do. But we looked at a few different options last season, and the manager sort of played me in the number 10 position for, a good, probably a third of the season. I played in that position, and it's something that, I can do. I don't feel like I'm at my best there. I think I've got a lot more to offer when I am playing as an out-and-out striker, whether that's with a partner or just with someone off me. And this season, again, we didn't have the best of starts. We drew a couple of games, and we sort of tweaked it a little bit, and we moved to sort of more of a two up front, or a sort of a one up with a one slightly off, either two out and out centre forwards or a centre forward and a smaller one running off them. That's the main thing that's helped me, I think, is not getting too isolated and having good numbers around you to bring others into the game. And your job, obviously, is to score goals, but sort of you need to hold the ball up on the halfway line, look after it, build attacks from there, and then you've got to rely on your teammates to create the chances. And they've done that very well for me this season, and thankfully I've been able to take them.
So for a forward, a true out-and-out forward, to be absolutely on song, there's a lot of elements there, isn't there? A feeling in their absolute natural position, feeling supported in the way they like to be supported. There's a lot going on there to get you fine-tuned to do what you feel you are primarily on the pitch for, John, which is to put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, exactly that. And, anyone that's seen me play probably knows I'm not going to get the ball and run past five or six players. That's not one of my strengths. I am reliant on obviously getting the service and getting chances in the 18-yard box. But there's a process to how them chances come around. As I say, if the ball's coming up to you and you keep giving it away on the halfway line, or your touch is sloppy and we're not able to keep the ball and build attacks, then the chances are never come for me. So there's a lot more to it than just being a striker that, you know, just waits in the 6-yard box like an old school goal hanger and waiting for their chances. You've got to be involved, and you've got to do the basic parts right, which obviously helps get your team up the pitch. And with the creative players we've got, I know that if I can do that bit and bring them into the game and give them confidence, then they're going to supply the chances, which ultimately gets me the goals, which obviously gives myself confidence as well.
So early doors, obviously you started off and were in around Kenny Jackett, your current manager, back when you got going at Millwall. But then you had that procession of loans, you know, 8 loans in 6 years at 7 different clubs. At what point did you start to feel totally comfortable in your own skin as a footballer? At what point did it click for you?
It was a strange one. I always felt confident in my ability. If I'm being totally honest, I felt like when I came through at Millwall, I started playing in the first team in the Championship, and I probably wasn't ready, to be honest. My time went a little bit backwards. I probably needed to be on loan at them early years at sort of 18, 19, 20. Whereas I was sort of chucked into an environment where we're at Millwall, we're a new Championship club at the time. We were struggling sort of every season. It would be looking to stay up would be the main thing. The chances weren't coming. There's lots of pressures playing for Millwall anyway, which is a great part of playing for them and is a fantastic club. But I just physically wasn't ready for the demands of Championship football at sort of 18, 19, 20 to play Saturday, Tuesday every week and perform. So then the manager, who's obviously my manager now, Kenny, left. New managers came in, felt it was a good idea for me to go on loan, and every loan spell was a learning curve. And I sort of felt like when I went to Cheltenham first half of the season, again, it wasn't sort of my best loan spell in terms of goals. I played a little bit on the wings, both sides, and again, it wasn't my best position, but I felt like I sort of learnt a lot there. I was maybe 22, 23 at the time. And then I went to Gillingham back into the season. I was obviously at Cheltenham in League Two, and then Gillingham sort of said to me in League One, would you want to come on loan? And I was out of contract at the end of the season at Millwall. I was told sort of by Ian Holloway at the time that I wouldn't be getting a new contract. And it was an opportunity for me to sort of get in the shop window, being from obviously South London. Gillingham wasn't far. There was a lot of things that sort of felt like it was going to work well at the time. Went there on loan. We were sort of just above the relegation zone. We ended up having a good run and sort of only probably being a win or two away from the playoffs. And at the time, sort of it started with Andy Hessenthaler and a few others, sort of the gang of four were sort of in charge. And then the late Justin Edinburgh come in and took charge, which sort of kicked on my career a little bit. I got sort of maybe eight goals there. And then I thought, oh, brilliant, I'm out of contract. I'm going to hopefully do enough to sign here. And then Neil Harris, who I used to be his boot boy, he was then my reserve team manager. he then became the first team manager at Millwall and said, look, we're gonna give you an opportunity. And this was obviously back in League One now. And I sort of thought, well, yeah, you know, I'll give it one last crack. And it didn't work out there again. And I went to Northampton at the next season and won the league convincingly in League Two and helped score some goals in the back end of the season to help them sort of over the line. And at that point there, at sort of 23, 24, I knew a lot more about my game. I'd probably racked up a good, you know, probably getting close to 200, 150, 200 games by then. And a lot of them on loan, obviously, but I felt I knew what my strengths were. I knew what my weaknesses were. And I just kept working on my strengths, and signing for Doncaster at the time was the best thing that I ever done. I met Darren Ferguson and couldn't speak highly enough of him. As soon as I left the room, I was like, I'm signing here 100%. I don't care whoever comes in, I'm signing here. And my 3 years at Doncaster were amazing. Obviously, on and off the pitch were as good as they could have gone for me, really. And yeah, obviously, that's the sort of the time that over them sort of 3-4 years that I've figured out what I'm really good at and what I'm not so good at. So I tend not to do the other stuff, not too much.
Yeah. I mean, listen, there's a rich tapestry of managerial names. All, I assume, John, have had a little bit of input into you over the years. And without naming names, have you ever had completely contradictory advice where you've been at one club with one manager and they've said you should be doing A, B and C, and then 2 years down the line, you're somewhere else and somebody tells you the exact opposite? Or does it not work like that?
Nothing that sticks out at me that says that there was anything different to the... As you say, I have played under some good managers.
You have, mate. You've played under some crackers. I mean, lots of people with loads of history, pedigree in winning promotions, and great motivators as well. I'm assuming to be in something like a Chris Wilder dressing room at Northampton. In a good partnership with James Collins at the time, were you as well? Was that about around there? I mean, you're feeling sky high. I remember coming to a Friday training session before you played. I don't know where you were playing. I think you might have been training at Barnsley or something on the Friday afternoon. You could just feel the atmosphere around the whole training pitch. It was awesome to witness, actually.
Yeah, this is, as you say, obviously, Chris Wilder's gone on to do some tremendous stuff with Sheffield United. It's amazing the way that he's gotten playing. I know they've not started the season too well this year, but his ideas are brilliant. And whatever level he's been at, he's done well. Obviously, Alan Neil was his assistant. I went to Torquay on loan and he was actually the manager at the time. He then got sacked and I think that was when he said, I'm not being a manager no more, I'll go be number two. And then obviously Darren Ferguson, Grant McCann, Ian Holloway, Neil Harris, obviously Kenny Jackett. There's been so many that have all played massive parts. Justin Edinburgh. They've all played so many parts in lots of different ways. And one thing that I can say sort of at the end of my career is that I've played under some really good managers and that every single one of them has given me something to learn and work on. And whether it's been the smallest detail or something really big, it's helped me so much in my career. And I do honestly thank every single one of them because they've helped me.
I love the makeup of League One at the moment. And, you know, obviously two of your rivals are former managers. Grant McCann's in charge of Hull and then Darren Ferguson, Peterborough. You've got this weekend as well. I wonder how essential Kenny is, because as much as the club have missed out the last couple of years in the playoffs, his own track record, 5 of the last 7 League One seasons he's done, he's been either promoted or at least reach the playoffs. So again, there's a lot of experience he can draw on to pass on to you in certain scenarios, I'm guessing.
Yeah, definitely. As you say, his experience, especially at this level, you know, Millwall, Wolves, he's done very well. He knows how to win games of football in this league. And as you say, the league is very tight this year. There's probably going to be, as there is most years, there's probably going to be 7, 8, 9 teams that all fancy their chances. And it's about being consistent. It's an old cliche, but you've got to be consistent. You know, everyone's going to lose games this season. The league is strong. Even the teams that you may class as weaker teams, they're still good players. There's still good teams in the league. There's still hard places to go. The fixtures are relentless. So there's not going to be a team that, you know, sort of like the Luton a couple of years ago where they just steamrolled it. I don't think there's going to be a team like that. I think it will be close throughout the season, and it's just being consistent and trying to win as many games as you can and pick up as many points as you can against the teams that are most definitely in and around you.
John, do you fear the playoffs after what's happened the last couple of years? Do you openly discuss it, trying to push for one better, get automatic done, get a longer summer off and not have the sort of strain? I mean, where does that sit with you?
You know, obviously, pretty soon after the playoffs are finished, it's sort of, you have to put it to the back of your mind and move on to the next season. Because if you do sort of let it linger too long, it's going to affect this season. So, our aim is to try to get automatic playoffs, but it's definitely not something that we fear if we do end up being in there. You know, myself, I've lost sort of 2 penalty shootouts in the last 2 playoffs. one with Doncaster, one with Portsmouth. So that is a tough way to settle it in sort of both semi-finals. But and obviously Portsmouth have got there twice and not quite got over the line. But it's definitely not something that you can fear because, as I say, the league is so strong. It is going to be so tight come the end of the season. And we've got to make sure that we can be consistent and give ourselves a chance of being in the top two, sort of going into the business end of the season from sort of February onwards, where that is going to be the business end. That is where, you know, you turn in from sort of maybe a fifth, sixth place team and you have a run at it and you can get first or second. So we need to just make sure we're in and around the mix, sort of getting through the Christmas period and January period where it's really busy, and then see where we are and sort of assess and go on from there.
Listen, I don't want to hold you up because we are talking to you before training. You've confessed just before we started recording this that you're the fine gatherer. Are there some persistent offenders? People that just keep turning up late to training and you've just got to say, come on. And how much is a fine these days? What's your top ranking fine? What's the worst misdemeanor at the moment?
We're big on lates. We don't like lates. It's, you know, just a punctual thing is, you know, you should never be late.
What's the fine for that these days, John? What if you is there a sort of tier if you're late again and again and again? It gets worse.
You can roll over. Obviously, late on a match day is a big one. Late to a bus if we're travelling is a big one. Training's a little bit more lenient, but you still don't want to pick too many of them up. So, to be honest, the boys started a bit sloppy, but they've got better in time. Every week when I'm putting names in our group chat and people keep seeing that their money has to get put in, I think they've realised that he's taking it quite seriously. It's been good, to be fair. The boys have been bang on it. So
good. I'm glad to hear it. Listen, if it doesn't work out for you in your football career, obviously it is. I think you're well established on that path. You could always get a job as a bailiff or a debt collector or something like that, John, couldn't you? Finally, I don't think I know what your goal celebration is. I can actually see you as we're recording this. What are you instinctive with that? Do you have a set celebration? Where are you? What do you do when the ball is in the back of the net? Where are you
sort
at?
As I say, Alan Shearer was my hero growing up. So it's sort of the traditional one arm.
Left or right?
Right.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, the right, yeah. And then, just a sort of little kiss and point to the sky. And that's me. And sometimes I do go a bit off piece if I feel a bit giddy, but I tend to just stick to them ones.
Yeah. Tell me something, honestly. Did you used to practice that in the back garden, you know, when you were a kid and you were, you know, obviously you were heroing Alan Shearer. Did you actually used to practice that as a kid and now you get to do it for real?
Yeah, all the time, yeah. I used to be honest, I used to go round to on the corner of where my mum's house was, there was a sort of a church with a bit of an open concrete area, and that's where we'd all sort of play. And I'd be running around there with my arm in the air, and then all of a sudden a window would go through, and then I'd hear my mum shout in the garden and I'd have to run back around the corner. So I moved faster running back from there to my mum's house running on the pitch. But I think it's something you dream of. You know, scoring goals. If you're a striker, you want to score goals, and just practicing when you're younger, and then to do it now on a pretty regular basis is a great feeling.
John, it's been a great chat. Thanks for joining us on the Official EFL podcast.
Thank you very much.
The Official EFL podcast with Mark Tennant.
Aside from a handful of pilot events in September, after 266 days, the return of fans to EFL grounds finally started with Carlisle United welcoming a maximum of 2,000 for the midweek game with Salford City. Charlton Athletic, Shrewsbury Town and Cambridge United entertained a similar number, Luton Town and Wickham Wanderers 1,000 apiece. In total, 34 EFL clubs are now currently able to welcome back a number of home supporters only. I wonder what was going through the mind of Carlisle United's chief executive, Nigel Clebbins, as the turnstiles at Brunton Park approached opening time. How much have you felt the weight of responsibility in reopening the ground? And how much were you also aware of getting the tone absolutely pitch perfect? Because obviously, throughout the country, there are still several hundred people dying every day as a result of COVID. So, yes, of course, you want to push. Yes, of course, you want to provide that asset to the community, that brilliant experience. But as chief executive, I guess you've got that delicate line to wander as well.
Yeah, we've been always mindful of that. We've all known people who've suffered from this. We've had a number of people who've suffered bereavements around the club linked to COVID. So it's really sensitive. And we saw that at the start when we had the first pilot game. There were calls to accelerate really quickly. And you kind of feel whether it's right or not. It's hard to explain. When you speak to people, you can feel whether they think it's right to push on or not. And I think we've been very much guided by that. All our owners live in the city, so they know, they speak to people all the time. They know people who've suffered from this, and people in hospitals, people who work in hospitals. So it's been really important. We worked with the city council right at the start, and we opened our big footprint to testing. So we had a testing site at Brunson Park right at the beginning, so we could see the ebbs and flows of how the virus spread. So we had periods where it was quite quiet and the testing site opened and then closed reasonably quickly. And then we had periods where they would ring me on a Friday and say, Nigel, can I come and can we open the testing site Saturday, Sunday? We've had an outbreak in a big factory. We need to test 300 people and we need to do it now. Can you help? So we kind of felt that. So as time's gone on, that site has gone away. The testing system's changed. So you get an appreciation of what you're kind of dealing with, which has meant we've been more comfortable with it. We can see the numbers across the county, how they've ebbed and flowed. So again, we can see where we are in terms of the risk and the tier. So we knew we'd be around tier two, but it's really important. And we're looking at that all the time.
Just listening to you describe so eloquently how you've dealt with this balancing act. Just imagine if we'd been having a conversation a year ago, you would think I was crazy if I had said to you, this is how your 2020 is going to unfold. The job of a chief executive, eh? Nothing like this in the handbook that they would teach you at how to be a chief executive in an EFL club.
No, it's been a unique time. We're used to having to deal with unusual circumstances in football. I've said it many times, when I go into work on a Monday morning, lots of times I don't know what I'm going to expect. So we're kind of used to being quite adapting, but this is completely off the scale. And I think what we've tried to do all along is accept that and be really realistic that whilst everybody wants some certainty and an ability to look ahead long term, I formed the view really early on back in March that we were going to go through a period where we didn't know from week to week. And therefore, the best approach was to not jump to major conclusions, try and do things and make decisions that were good in the short term, but didn't damage us long term, and make decisions that gave us flexibility and admit really quickly if we had to change our minds. So, for instance, we're quite honest about it. We had the trial game. And we had to put some temporary this is the reality. We had to put some temporary dugouts in for social distancing. So we can't afford to buy permanent dugouts that become temporary and then are taken out. So we call a favour in from a scaffolding company, and he comes and he builds them, and you measure them and you do all this. The fans come in and they're too big and they can't see over the top of them.
Oh, mate.
So the fans are saying, oh, it's great to be back, but next time, can you have some dugouts that we can see over? We can obviously accommodate everybody. We move everybody around and it's no big deal. No big deal. Yeah. It's fine. Yeah. But then we come to move them and I say at the scaffolding company, can you come and move the dugouts? And it's kind of, well, we've done you a favour once, but we've got problems of our own. Can you find another way? So you have to then go to the fans and say, look, we can't move the dugouts and have to stay. We're going to have to move you. So just move back a bit. You get a better view. Everything will be fine. Let's move on. So we do that and everything's fine and we move on.
But Nigel, I can just imagine I've stood in that spot. I've sat in that spot for the last 72 years. Why? I can't be moved. It's nice to know the basic characteristics of being a football supporter, Steve. Can I ask you a long-term residual effect on supporter base? Because there was one survey I read suggested 28% of fans surveyed felt closer to their EFL club, but 10% said they cared less. Did you at any point worry about a damaging long-term effect on your supporter base? The longer they're away from football, they might find other things to do with the time that would normally have been devoted to their beloved club.
Absolutely. It's one of the biggest concerns that we have sitting here now. And you, when you, again, speaking to fans, it's really important. For me, my job, that I speak to fans, and I was speaking to some last night, and you get the feedback from forums and on social media, you can see how things change. And we're very traditional in football, as you say, about where we, to the meter and in the terrace, where we stand and behind which barrier. But when you hear people, things have kind of changed, and attitudes do change. So what we've seen is the habit of coming to a ground that might not be the greatest, the experience might be real, authentic, but it's not, might not be the greatest comfortable experience, that you break that habit and people move on to other things, especially young people now, where we know that football, and there's lots of other options compared to maybe 25 years ago. So we're seeing that. The other interesting thing is that we're seeing people who might be older, less IT savvy, who are saying, oh, I've got into iFollow now. And on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night where iFollow is available, they're saying, oh, actually, can I still watch it on iFollow? And will iFollow still be available when fans can go back? So we're seeing fans where we've had the holy grail of the 3 o'clock watch, 3 o'clock kickoff. Fans are saying, when fans can go back, can we keep the 3 o'clock kickoff? Will we still be able to watch iFollow at 3 o'clock? So I think there's some serious structural changes coming in fan bases that have been triggered by this. And it's not just young people, it's your traditional football fan, which I think will surprise a few people.
Well, listen, well done getting your first game on. Where do we go from here, do you think, Nigel? How do you think the next couple of months sort of work out?
Well, from our point of view, we're in Tier 2. Based on the rules that are in place now, which may change, but based on what we're faced with now, there's an option then to go into Tier 1, and that gives you a capacity of up to 4,000 for a club like us. So what we're looking at Carlisle is saying, right, reviewing what went on last night, are we all happy with it? Can we go to 4,000? If we do that, what do we need to do about it? What modifications do we need to make? So again, as I said before, from our point of view, we're ready, adaptable, and able, if we can, to move to that 4,000. And that's what we see as our next stepping stone. When that will be, again, it's back to this uncertainty question. We don't know, but we need to be ready. So we'll talk to our safety advisory group about what they see we need to do to get there, so that if it comes out, we're not waiting for that announcement to then start working. We know what we're going to do before it comes along. So that's our kind of plan. In the longer term, I think everybody is focused on the vaccines, so that will open up more movement and bigger capacities. But I think reading about it, the effects with double jabs required and the time to inoculate everybody, it will, or vaccinate everybody, it could be into the spring and March time. So I think, as far as my view is, I'm looking at 21-22, that new season, as the start of when we will be back, hopefully, to be able to have our full capacity. And if we're near the top of the league, to be having crowds of 8,000, 10,000. It's a shame now, because we're doing really well in the league. We've got our best start to a season since 16-17, so we're doing really well, and no doubt we could easily get we normally get more than 4,000 anyway, but we'd be pushing up to 6,000-8,000 easily. So we're getting a double hit. Not only are we not able to get our normal capacity, we can't get our special capacity at doing well on the pitch.
Well, listen, well done all of you. Great to talk to you, Nigel.
You too.
This is the official EFL podcast.
Listening to Nigel Clibbins and here to help us dissect all the other key stories from the Sky Bet Championship Leagues 1 and 2 of the past 7 days is the former Oldham Athletic Barnsley and most recently Bristol City manager Lee Johnson. From a manager's perspective, Lee, I'm guessing having fans, not having fans, yes, of course, there's a big downside, but I bet you there's some positives as well in terms of instructions, those players that are a bit more brittle, not feeling the pressure of a vociferous crowd, etc.
I'll be honest, originally going into that, I thought that might be the case. And you could sometimes they would call an individual a Champions League trainer, and then on the match day, they can't quite bring it. But to be honest, it's been so difficult without the fans, I think, for players, because they live for that. You know, when you're that little boy playing in the park, and what you're doing is you're visualising being one of your idols. And when the goal's scored, you're reenacting the crowd cheering. And that's inevitably what makes a young player good, because it's that lust, that thirst, that desire to impress the crowd and get that feedback, if you like, positive feedback off the crowd. And yeah, even I didn't think it would be as detrimental to football as it has been.
So similarly, in those few games you had without crowds, did you find yourself sort of, honestly, you wanted the energy burst, but there was nowhere for it to go? Or you suddenly celebrated in the normal style and then realised that actually there was just empty stands all around you and you and a couple of your assistants jumping up and down, and nobody else was?
Yeah, well, it just felt like a pre-season game, but with the jitters, if you like, of the 3 points that's on it. And obviously it was surreal in terms of, like, you're getting change in the concourse and stuff like that. So it just felt very strange. And some players adapted well and some didn't. But there's nothing better than the live game, but also feeling the emotion of the crowd. You know, that pressure is a privilege as a manager. But also, obviously, it comes with sometimes a negative side and you know, I mean, the heckling, if you like, of opposition fans and stuff like that. So, but that's all part of the fun, and the quicker we can get fans back, and the better. It's not ideal that there's 1,000 or 2,000 fans back at the moment, but it's definitely a step in the right direction.
So, in the Sky Bet Championship, injury-ravaged leaders Norwich and Bournemouth both wobble to a single point from the last two games. Brentford continue their best start since the early 1950s, and Wayne Rooney's Derby County, as they shall from now on be known until we know otherwise, concede not one but two late equalisers. And I'm suddenly, and it hadn't struck my silly brain until the point at which we started this, I'm suddenly thinking you were in a bit of a similar situation to Wayne when you went into Oldham, weren't you? Did you kibosh playing straight away as soon as you got the managerial job? Did I?
I had an injury at 31, and it was just restricting my movement. It was an injury, a big tackle that was a bad idea with a player called Danny Shittu, I'm sure you'll remember. Big strong lad, and unfortunately my ankle bore the brunt of his strength and power. And I went up to Kilmarnock for a bit and had a great time there, even though it was a short spell, won the Scottish Communities Cup, came back down to England, and at that point had a few opportunities sort of lower down, but managed to get a conversation with the owner of Oldham. And a couple of hours later, or a couple of days later, suddenly I'm thrust into a relegation battle in League One as a rookie. I think it's probably a little bit different to Wayne in the sense that I had completed my coaching badges. So I'd done a lot of hours starting from when I was 24, really, at Yeovil, taking various teams and youth teams and academies at Bristol City as a player. And then Kenny Shields was kind enough to let me take the passing drills and the warm-ups and various keep balls at Kilmarnock. So I'd certainly put the hours in and I'd got the badges. So and of course, I had a front row seat for 25 years watching my dad do it.
Listen, we try and concentrate on two or three specific clubs every week on the official EFL podcast rather than just do a scattergun and trying to deal with half the league or something. But Brentford stand out to me this week, particularly Ivan Toney, who's notched his 13th goal of the season. And A, they're bouncing back, but B, they're doing this. They lost Ollie Watkins' goals, 25 last season. Saeed Benrahma got 17. And maybe you're just starting to sort of get their balance right, because they hadn't quite cracked that dearth left down the left-hand side of their front three, I think, until this last couple of games.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Brentford are just brilliant at what they do. Of course, last year they'd be absolutely devastated not to have got over the line in those last couple of games when they had the opportunity, and that meant that the team was broken up. And unfortunately for them, obviously the top quality players in Benrahma and Watkins end up moving on. But they make a really big statement, I thought, by signing like Ivan Toney. And obviously the fee was big, and it's been brilliant to see him hit the ground running. Obviously, I had him for a short period.
At Barnsley, of course.
We took him on loan. And he's a really nice lad. Like, obviously, he's matured physically and in his game and his personality, and he's performing really well. He would have felt probably the pressure of that, you know, such quality players leaving, him expected to step in, and he's done that. I think that any player scoring goals in the Championship at the rate that Ivan Toney is means that obviously their value's gone up, and Brentford seem to churn that out year on year.
Who's surprised you in the Championship this season? And at the risk of putting you on the spot, because obviously at some point quite soon you might get a job and have to play one of them, who's really disappointed you?
I've watched the Championship obviously closely. And I think it's interesting. You've got the likes of Reading, obviously, that had a fantastic start. You've got Watford that look like the individuals are a really top side and they're stacked with depth. But obviously, a lot of their players at the start wasn't either fit or not willing to play because potentially Premier League moves on the horizon. You can see them coming through in the end, in the sense of Watford. And then you've got the likes of the clubs that are lower down, you know, like Gareth Ainsworth doing a fantastic job at Wickham and managed to turn round a difficult start. And you can see the spirit and you can see the identity when they play. And then you've got teams that I suppose would hope they would have started a little bit better. And I'm pleased for Neil Harris at Cardiff that he's got two really good wins at an important time. Just because Cardiff, again, have got a good squad and you'd be looking to sort of push them up to the top sort of six in the table like they did last year.
I'm not sure with your Bristol City connections whether you're allowed to praise the team just across the border there.
I can praise my mate, Neil Harris.
I think it's beyond that now.
I think, you know, I mean, what you learn when you come out of it and you have this little period is that you certainly have to appreciate everybody's work, what they're going through, and also their ability to dig in and turn it around.
Top of the Sky Bet Championship then, Norwich, followed by Bournemouth in the automatic promotion places. Watford just outside on goal difference, as are Reading, as are Bristol City. Brentford currently in sixth at the bottom. It is Derby, rock bottom, who find themselves, live maths, everybody, 5 points adrift of Nottingham Forest in the last position of safety. Fixtures this coming weekend. The Friday night game is Leeds' former team Barnsley at home to Bournemouth. The 12:30 on Saturday is Reading against Forest, 1 point from the last 12 without scoring. Brentford entertain Blackburn, Bristol City at home to Birmingham. Two of the promoted teams, Coventry and Rotherham, play each other. Derby still looking for that first win under Wayne Rooney. Visit Millwall, had drawn the previous six until the late defeat at Blackburn Rovers during the week. After their first defeat in 11, it's Norwich at home to Sheffield Wednesday. And Watford, with that amazing home record, they've won six of their last seven, at home to Cardiff. City, League One. With the FA Cup, most teams only had one game. Sunderland, though, had two, and after the first one, they parted company. With Phil Parkinson, winless run of five matches in all competitions, three in the league, left them in eighth. Is it me, or did that never quite feel like the right fit up there?
Well, it's hard for me to judge that. Obviously, I know Phil Parkinson personally through managing against his teams and also as a player playing against his teams as a manager. And he's a fantastic man, first and foremost, with his assistant, the other parky.
But fit's important, isn't it?
Fit is important, yeah. And listen, there's obviously a new ownership, isn't there, going into Sunderland. So they may well have their own ideas, but it doesn't detract from a man that would have put some solid work in place, if you like, ready for the next guy to take over. And I know that Phil Parkinson will do a very good job, obviously, at the next club he takes over.
And when an opportunity like that comes up, and when you find yourself looking at the sort of predicted, the betting list, the odds and all the rest of it, you find yourself on that list, is it because something is happening, Lee? Or is it just that your name is...
Are you thinking of having a bet, mate?
Well, or is it just that people speculate? I mean, seriously, if you see your name connected to a job and maybe you don't know anything about it, I mean, are you like, oh, I better ring my agent, what's going on here type of thing? I mean, I guess it's a strange place to be, is it? Your name is on the list as one of the possible new managers of Sunderland.
Yeah, well, I think, listen, to be linked with any club is obviously a good feeling, because it means somebody appreciates. In terms of the betting, it's always difficult. I don't look at that type of thing because I know how volatile it is. You know, obviously, you don't have to put a lot of money on to change the odds. Sometimes I think 50 quid will probably take someone from a 25-1 to an evens favourite. So it does
you know too much about this. To get your name up the list and put yourself in the consciousness of the new owners, it's probably worth the investment, isn't it? Put 100 on, then on that basis, you're going to become the absolute out-and-out favourite.
Yeah, I can assure you that type of mentality is not the one that would end up getting you that the job or success. So, no, for me, look, I remember when the Bournemouth job came up and instantly I was second favourite. And, I had no contact or anything like that. And I was really pleased for Jason Tindall that he got it. But at the same time, of course, it's flattering to be linked, because it means the external perception means that they believe that you might be a good fit for that one.
I think you'd be a good fit for lots of jobs. Ipswich, five league wins in the first six for Paul Lambert's team, and then five defeats in the last nine. Paul Lambert, after a midweek draw, talked about nonsense criticism and actually said to the media, "I don't read what you write or say, but I know the players feel it without a doubt." Is it me, or is that dangerous ground to get into, criticising the media?
I understand what he's saying. I think that as a manager, sometimes you have to be the best face in the room. And if you're affected by the negativity that can come to your door via media, via social media, and often clickbait media, as it is now, it is a way of the world, and obviously people have got their job to do. So, it's never nice if you break a relationship with a particular media person. You know, they've got to go way past the line for me to actually fall out with somebody like that, because I understand they've got a job to do. But obviously, he's a very experienced manager. They've had a great start. They've got a good squad. Ipswich is a huge club. It's a sleeping giant, really. And Paul Lambert's proven, if you like, at getting clubs out of that division. So I think you've got to just ride the waves, try and flatten the waves, and then obviously get the next win under your belt. And suddenly everything's back rosy in the garden.
I wonder if there's a little bit of be careful what you wish for as well, because a similar sort of process saw Mick McCarthy lose the job a few years ago. I don't think the owner had any appetite for him to go, but I think, you know, criticism in the media and then a swell of fan opinion got him out of the door. And obviously the season that followed was relegation. So, you know, everybody's got to be a little bit careful and be mindful of where clubs are. And nobody has a divine right, however big their heritage, to, you know, take one of those promotion spots.
No, inevitably any club owner is looking for the best fit, of course, for their football club. And sometimes that's a philosophy of play. Sometimes that's a man management style. Sometimes that's quality of leadership and sometimes quality of communication. So I think Ipswich and, I mean, I was born in Newmarket, so Ipswich and Norwich and Cambridge United were sort of the closest clubs around. Obviously, Dad had a spell at Cambridge United as manager and assistant. But it's such a huge bubble. You know, I've been lucky enough to live in the various bubbles, like the Manchester bubble with the big clubs there, the Yorkshire bubble, obviously with the likes of Leeds and
We better just clarify for anybody listening, Lee. We're not just in case anybody's half asleep listening to this. We're not talking COVID bubbles.
We're talking football bubbles.
Yeah, I'm just clarifying.
Fans. Yes, passionate fans that everything's all consuming. I experienced it in Scotland, obviously with Rangers and Celtic, Bristol with Bristol City and Bristol Rovers, and East Anglian type derby in that area of football. It's absolutely huge. People live for that there. And you can see why the intensity is so strong when obviously results swing both ways.
Indeed. Shrewsbury appointed Steve Cottrell, out since March 2018, 5 promotions in 700 games. But is being out for 2.5 years the potential new normal for some managers? Do they have to accept the fact that some are going to sit out for longer than others and have to wait for that right opportunity?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that Steve would have looked at it. I'm sure he would have had offers, not just from England, but from various parts of Europe and the world. Obviously, his record stacks up as being a top one. And again, he's another one that is proven at that level in terms of promotions. Interestingly, he took his old striker, a mild striker, Aaron Wilbraham, to go and be the assistant. And I think that'll be a lovely little partnership there. Obviously, the experience of Steve and Albs is very, very good in terms of that feel with the players. He's got a great rapport with the players, and obviously he brings that leadership quality to add to Steve. So I think that'll be... I like Shrewsbury. I've always liked Shrewsbury. I like the owner. I like the football club, and I like the manager that they've put in charge and the assistant. So I would see them as a club that I'm sure will progress over the next couple of years.
Yeah, the Shrewsbury owner, I think, is in the catering business. And as a result, if you ever do have to pop up there for a midweek kind of media session or perhaps to watch a reserve game or something like that, he I always remember him saying something along the lines of, "I don't just want Danish kicking around. I want some proper cake in there as well." A man of my own heart. Top of the League One table. Hull just go on and on and on. A 4-point gap over second place Lincoln. Peter, who've had a little bit of a wobble in third. Charlton, Ipswich, Portsmouth, Sunderland sit just outside. And from the bottom, reading up, Wigan, Shrewsbury, Burton and Bristol Rovers. Fixtures this weekend. Well, the one that stands out, we had John Marquis on a little bit earlier, didn't we? But it's Portsmouth against Peterborough. 3 defeats in 4 in the league. 4 and 5 all competitions. Lincoln in second, head to Rochdale. Good 4-0 win away for them in the midweek. Charlton are in fourth, head to Shrewsbury. It's Sunderland against Wigan. In League Two, Cheltenham Town made it 6 wins in 7 in all competitions. It's 3 consecutive league wins for Leighton Orient. And having lost 5 league games in a row, Scunthorpe United's gradual resurgence continues with a 3rd win in their 5 matches since. Do you know what? That kind of thing strikes me, Lee. There's very fine margins in football, isn't there? Because I kind of looked at what Neil Cox was going through at Scunthorpe United, and as the wins clock up, you think, "Ooh, are they going to be trigger happy?" But a little bit of patience, and he's starting to turn the thing around. Actually, almost carbon copy of what's going on at Bolton Wanderers as well, where Ian Everett had a very sticky start, but suddenly find themselves not far off the playoffs. There are very fine margins in football.
There are, and it's important that a manager gets time, you know, to implement what you're trying to, particularly lower down. It's not always easy, because what you've got to do is you've got to try and blend the partnerships, and that cohesive partnership, like, for example, the left back and the left midfielder, 2 centre midfielders, become really important. Often teams get thrown together late through budget reasons, or through the fact that the clubs had difficulties or maybe lost their best couple of players to suitors in higher divisions. And it takes time. And it's that hard graft, really, on the training ground that you start to see come to the fore after probably between that 10 and 20 game period. And now, like you say, it looks like it's happening at those clubs.
And Cheltenham Town, you know, I always think of little clusters, and I always think of Cheltenham. Obviously, your dad was there for a period, so I guess you keep a little bit of an eye on them. But so I always sort of link them into that kind of out of Bristol, southwest catchment area, northern southwest catchment area. 6 wins in 7 for Michael Duff. Made the playoffs last time around. Those are the little quiet bits of work that really establish your managerial credentials, are they not?
Yeah, absolutely. You look at Flinney at Newport, and obviously the same at Cheltenham. And these are good young managers. You know, they've got a backstory in terms of they had good careers, solid careers as players. They've been good lads and obviously honed their leadership qualities, and they've worked under some really, really good managers. So they seem to have worked it out at that level. And of course, like Flinney in particular, who does it on a shoestring, and then Cheltenham have progressed and grown. It's a small club, but it's a family club. And obviously Dad got them promoted into the Football League, and has got nothing but good things to say about the club and the fan base that's there. So I think that the stability of these clubs give them the opportunity to really grow and develop and punch above their weight.
As you finish talking about those two managers, I can say the top three in League Two are Newport, Cheltenham and Exeter. Forest Green Rovers, Carlisle United, Cambridge United and Leyton Orient occupy the playoff places, and at the bottom it's Southend and Stevenage. Now, you did tell me before we started recording this you'd got a hot date with a sausage sandwich. What else are you doing for the rest of the day?
Actually, my wife is trying to, I would say, probably bully me into going Christmas shopping. But there's too much on at the moment. I need to just make sure that I tick all my media boxes for the likes of you, and make sure that everybody's happy with that. And and then I've got a couple of games to catch up on from last night. And we go again.
You go again, and you could go off to a League Two game this weekend, or at least keep an eye on it. You might be watching early kickoff, Scunthorpe against Leyton Orient, two of the form teams. Carlisle United are away at Bradford City. Cambridge entertain another one of Lee's former clubs, Oldham. It is second against third as Cheltenham play Exeter. Forest Green at Harrogate. Newport the leaders at Morecambe. And Stevenage and Southend, the bottom two teams, play each other. Lee, what a pleasure. And if I may say so, I've been able to look at your lovely head and part of your shoulders for the duration of recording this. Your hair's looking magnificent this morning as well, if I may say so. We're recording this quite early in the morning. Thank you for doing it for us.
Thank you, mate. Pleasure, and great work. Keep it up, and I wish everybody a fantastic weekend.
That's it for this week. A huge thank you to Lee Johnson, Nigel Clibbins and John Marquis. If you've enjoyed this week's episode, then do give us a 5-star rating, please. Press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you want to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next week for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.